Hey everyone, welcome to Recovery Rocks. This episode is sponsored by the folks at Sour Humanoid Vinegar.
And Sour
when I say the folks, I mean my partner who just started this amazing vinegar brand. Sour Humanoid is designed for cooking, created by a New York City sommelier who got sober after working at Michelin-starred restaurants and curating award-winning wine lists. This vinegar is an excellent way to make any meal special with very little effort. Check out some of the easy recipes at sourhumanoid.com. And we've had Nick on an episode before. He's, you know, a fellow sober entrepreneur, and we're excited to have Sour Humanoid sponsor this episode.
It's an amazing story, and I will give a brief testimonial just because I don't cook, but I have sent Sour Humanoid gift packs as gifts over the holidays to a couple of my friends who are big cooks, and it got rave reviews. So user tested, customer tested. And all thumbs up.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Recovery Rocks. We have a fabulous guest with us today, Queen Ruby Warrington. Say hello, Ruby.
Yay. Hi, everybody. Hi, Lisa. Hi, Tony.
We're so excited.
Listeners, if you're not familiar with the name Ruby Warrington, you've probably heard the term Sober Curious, which she created and has done many other things. But today we're going to talk about her new book, Women Without Kids. I read it twice. We were just talking physical and then audio, which is kind of a cool experience because you pick up things that you didn't, or I didn't catch the first time. But all three of us are women without kids that don't drink alcohol. So we're going to discuss those intersections today.
Yeah, and there are intersections. I mean, for me, because I actually had a really hard time pitching this book, selling this book. Publishers weren't really interested, even though this has been a subject that has been something I've written multiple times in my career in journalism, and having always been a woman without kids. I mean, having always known I didn't want to be a mother, you know, and always kind of walked that path. This has been my whole life in many ways. And so it was kind of disappointing, I suppose, to hear people say, Ruby's not the person to write this book. We don't think this is the right next book from Ruby. But it's because Sober Curious had made such an impact. And my name, despite all of the other things I've written on over my 25-year career as a writer, that was the thing that I was kind of known for. But for me, there's a huge connection between Sober Curious and what I'm discussing in that book and what I'm presenting there and this book, Women Without Kids, which is that both of these are about walking an unconventional path and going against the grain of all of the cultural societal conditioning that says this is what a good life looks like. This is what your life is supposed to be, you know? So for me, that's like a real through line in both of these projects. And so I do think actually I've had many people reach out to me while I've been promoting Women Without Kids to say, I also don't drink. Like, and I do, I wonder if there's something about sober people and people who don't have children, which is slightly, I guess, rebellious or countercultural in by nature in a way. Perhaps we're more likely to question, because plenty of people question their drinking but never do anything about it, right? Because it's so
right.
It's so automatically puts you in the outside group to be a non-drinker. Unless you join a recovery program and that kind of becomes your whole world, you find another in-group to be part of. But to deliberately and willfully become part of the outside group is very, it's challenging, it's confronting. And so, yeah, choosing not to be a parent is one of those situations, just like choosing not to be a drinker. Yeah.
It really is. And that reminds me of the question that I asked when I went to your Strand event, your launch event with Rachel Cargill. I was like, how do you deal with the family pressures of being a woman without kids? And your answer was, you know, very similar to what you just said. It's like, you don't drink alcohol and you had to deal with the societal familial expectations that come with that and explaining that to people. And it really is very similar, where like sobriety has set me up to feel more confident in
not having children and having those uncomfortable conversations.
Right. I'll speak for myself. Choosing not to drink and going against all of the external pressure to drink and staying true to myself for my own incredibly personal individualistic reasons can equally be applied to the kind of pressure that people might experience around not having children. I'm so glad you brought that question up because I was thinking about it I've thought about it so often afterwards. Is it okay if I kind of like repeat it here and give you an additional answer?
Yes. Oh, please.
So Tawny's question was around along the lines of, I'm an only child and as the only person kind of who is potentially going to continue this part of my family tree, the question is, well, what about our lineage? What about the legacy of our family? You know, so that kind of even goes a bit deeper than just when are you going to make us grandparents or why aren't you doing this thing that everybody's supposed to do? And I was thinking, Tawny, I think this is a great opportunity to have a conversation with your family about why that's so important to them. Why does it really matter? And there's not necessarily a right or a wrong answer to that, but I think it could be the start of a really interesting conversation about what legacy means, why that maybe it'd be helpful for you to understand why that's so important to them. Maybe have some more compassion for them in their pressuring of you in this area, you know? So I don't know, that's just something else I've been thinking about. And that's, of course, very similar to the sober curious approach, which is, well, let's be curious. Let's ask more questions where there is a rigid rule, where there is an expectation, where there is this external pressure, where there is entitlement on behalf of others to interfere with a very private business. Why is that? Where's that coming from? Like, what's the root of that, you know? And the more of those conversations the more of those conversations we can have, the better I think we'll understand each other and ourselves, and hopefully the more compassion and empathy we'll have for each other's choices.
I love that. Thank you for expanding on that. Cause it, you know, even after at the event, this other woman came up to me and she goes, I'm also an only child and I'm struggling with exactly what you're talking about. And so that was validating to hear. And I have no cousins. So it's literally like, it's always just been me and a bunch of adults. And so it's, you know, and I had a similar conversation with my dad. This is, I don't know, might be a tangent, but he's shocked that I have no desire to be a homeowner. And he's like, you're paying so much for rent in New York City. Why don't you buy? And I was like, why would I own a home? That is not appealing to me at all. And I don't know. So like that started conversations with some of my friends. I was just like, is it generational? Are less millennials wanting to own homes because we have so much student loan debt? We're having less children. We're like, our goals are just different than previous generations. So that, you know, that led to a whole other conversation with my dad. And so I don't know if you or Lisa have any thoughts on that.
Well, there's something there about generational differences that I think come up with every generation, right? And I think that that can be the cause of so much misunderstanding and prejudice and scolding, you know, particularly from older generations. I'm sure millennials and Gen X do it to Gen Zs. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yes, we do.
We all have lots of opinions about how the new generations are living their lives based on the fact that, you know, they're not doing the things that we think are the right things to do necessarily. So yeah, I don't know. I do think that's another interesting factor here, but yeah, I wonder if your lack of a feeling like a need to, because I do own property and part of me in a way I'm like really, it feels really good to know that I'll be able to leave it to my nephew. Anything that's kind of like the result of this material inheritance that I might leave, you know, to be able to pass that on to another generation does feel like a really important thing actually, because there hasn't been a lot of property ownership on that side of the family. I'm kind of like, it's new in our family to be able to own property on this particular branch of the family. And so it feels really good to know that I've done that thing and that my nephew one day will be able to benefit from that. But I guess when you know that there's going to be nobody that comes after you.
Yeah, I'm not an auntie. Like I literally don't, I would love to be an aunt.
There's no need really to leave any physical trace. I think that's very liberating personally. You know, I think that's kind of exciting. It's like, yeah, just live for now. And I, in, you know, in the book, I really do frame this question of, is something ending with me when I don't have kids, as potentially a liberation, you know, a liberation uh-huh. from, particularly if we can recognize that there have been sort of cycles of unnecessary suffering being passed on in our lineage, which so many of us have that in our lineage somewhere, you know, to really consciously claim that this ends with me in this lifetime, you know? So that's like something.
When we, all three of us have books to pass on.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, I feel, you know, I didn't own any property like you, Tawny. I had, for all the years I lived in New York, I was lucky enough to have found a really good rent deal on a really good apartment in a really great area. And I always felt, and I'm older than both of you, and I always felt that so many people would say to me, why are you rent all the time? When are you going to buy something? When are you going to buy something? And that was like in the height of my drinking and using also. And I kept thinking, I didn't even put art on my walls. I was like, I need to be able to get out of here tomorrow if I want to, right? Nothing seemed permanent to me. Nothing was a home. I never made my places homey because I always thought they were sort of like a holding pen also for my next thing. And as I had like 12 years in active addiction before I bottomed out, like a lot of, you know, when I finally got sober, I was 38 and I was like, wow, a lot of things now are, you know, I'm not where I was when I moved into the city at 25 anymore. And there was this feeling of, wow, I felt like I sort of missed the boat on when I would have, you know, had kids, when I would have bought a house, done whatever. I mean, I was single when I got married, or I was single when I got sober. And we, when Craig and I married and I was 40, we bought a home together in Santa Fe, but I never owned part of anything. I had always, you know, been renting. And I had this feeling of transience of, I have an amazing niece and nephew. I have a million cousins and all that stuff. But I still felt like I wasn't leaving anything behind that was mine. And that was like, when the book came out, I was like, okay, this is what I'm leaving. Like, I'm not leaving a legacy of genetics or anything like that. My own genetics scared me. But I felt like this is what I leave here. This will be my legacy. And as soon as that came out, it really relieved some of those, you know, I think I'm 57. So, you know, they were really ingrained feelings when I was younger of like, this is what you do. And like you said, Ruby, like, this is what a real life kind of looks like. These are the expectations. You get married, you have kids, you have a house. I was able to let that go. But the other piece of it, besides the book, was also this feeling like once I got sober, I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, those expectations and that need to fill a legacy is just a story I've been told, right? And now I'm sober and I get to live every day in today. And yes, I plan for the future because we need to plan for the future. But there's no reason that has to include children or a house. I'm not a failure because I didn't reproduce, you know, and in a lot of ways, the things that I've been able to do and experience, I only get to do because I didn't have children, you know, the life that we live today, you know, would be totally different if we had had kids or if we had met, you know, 10 years before we met, you know, and I'm so grateful for every day that I wake up and go, you know, wow, thank you. You know, first thing I do is look at the ceiling and go, thank you. While it has, you know, when I feel like I'm missing out is when I see my friends who are my age, who have children who are now in their 20s, and they've got that cool relationship with them and they get to, you know, do all those things. But there's also all those friends who have kids who are really struggling in their 20s. You know, it's not, you don't, it's, we have this ideal of if we have kids, it's going to be a certain way. And you don't know, you know. So it's just it's not a better or lesser path. It's just a different path.
Exactly. There's no guarantee for how it will turn out. Like, that speaks to the question that, you know, I'm sure you guys have been asked, or at least kind of come up against in the culture of, like, but who will look after you when you're old if you don't have children? This is, like, probably one of the number one sort of fear-mongering comment that would make me question my own inner knowing around this. But yeah, there's no guarantees about how that's going to play out, you know? There are plenty of people, I read a statistic recently actually that said that 60% of people in nursing homes in the US never receive any visitors, you know? And this is presuming that most people have children, but children who don't visit them, who may be involved in their care on a financial level, maybe paying for their care. And that's definitely something that I have really been thinking about a lot more as I age. I'm 47 now, and just really getting more focused about putting retirement savings in place and prioritizing that for this kind of second half of my life, I suppose, and getting more serious about that. Because I think writing the book did make me confront that question in a really real way. Like, okay, yes, there's no guarantee that having a child means someone's going to be there to look after me. In fact, there are plenty of people in their 70s and 80s who are still supporting their children, right?
Yes.
And the fact is that I do support my mother in multiple ways, including financially, and there isn't going to be a me to do that for me. So I need to make sure that I'm consciously putting those things in place for myself now. So that's a Tawny, that's a property ownership bonus. We hope. I mean, who the hell knows what will happen with the economy over the next 30, 40 years.
Totally.
I mean, like, there's no guarantee. Honestly, there's no guarantees in anything. And I do think that very kind of, you know, that tenet, which is very central to recovery, one day at a time. Like, if all of us lived that way, truly, if all of us truly lived that way, I think we'd be living in quite a different world. You know, if we could really focus our energies on what am I doing today to create security, to be connected to the people I love, to act on my dreams, to contribute something of value. Like, if we really approached every single day that way, I think we would be living in a very different world versus how is my life going to look in 10 years and what should I be freaking out about today? Based on how I want my look. Tawny, I have a question for you as well. You said something really interesting, which I think is quite key, or potentially quite key. I'm just curious about this. You said growing up, it was always just you and a bunch of adults. And I'm wondering if you think that had any kind of influence on your feelings about becoming a parent. Like, I don't know. I just always really, I personally always wanted to be grown up. Like, I always wanted to be a grown up and kind of have an autonomous, independent life. And I definitely think that in a way factored into me not wanting to be drawn back into the world of childhood. Because I never really felt, I didn't really feel like I was very good at being a kid. I never really related to other kids on a kid level. Like, I really liked being around grown-ups and I liked having grown-up conversations from a very young age. And for me, a barrier or something that I was rejecting, I suppose, in my decision not to become a parent was like this sound. I mean, this is just me stating a preference. But like, for me, the idea of going to like after school activities and play groups and all of that kind of stuff is just like, oh no, just no, just no. I just can't. There's no part of me that knows how to be. I don't know how to be in those kind of environments. And yeah, and I think part of it is because my parents, they both will proudly tell me, oh, we always spoke to you like a grown-up. We never spoke to you like a child. And I just, I don't know. I wonder if any of that is relatable to you and your own feelings about becoming a parent.
You know, yes. And it's something that has recently come up in therapy that I'm unpacking over the last few months of how it was all me and people that were, my mom had me at 21 and my dad was 24. So everyone was, you know, at least 20 years older than me. And like I said, no cousins. So I grew up very fast. You know, I my, you know, you've met my dad. We can link to the podcast episode with all four of us. My dad was and is a heavy metal musician. So when he was around, I was around the recording studio and band rehearsal with like people chugging alcohol from the bottle, you know? And then my time with my mom, was, you know, now I have the language to say she was, you know, emotionally immature. She didn't know how to take care of me because she wasn't given the tools. You know, I can crystal clearly see what happened with my parents, which you address in the book of like forgiving and accepting your parents. But it's, you know, but my therapist asked me, like, do you think you're apprehensive about having children because you feel like you've already raised your own mother? And I was like, fuck. You know, like it was one of those, like, I quit smoking cigarettes 10 years ago, but I really want one right now moments, you know? I was like, yes. Like now my mom, you know, my mom is doing a lot better. And she just graduated from college and I went home to, you know, watch her across the stage. But I even had this paternal feeling or maternal feeling watching my mom cross the stage of my alma mater. And I was like, that is a feeling that a mom should have for a kid, not a kid for the mom. But which is like, I think it's so fucking cool. She went back to college at 55. Like that is one of the coolest things to me. But that was just an example of how I do feel like I raised my mom. And up until the last few years, I was supporting her financially and emotionally. You know, I'd learned the term emotional husband in therapy of how my mom made me her whole world. And so my therapist giving me language to that was incredibly beneficial. And I'm also realizing the three of us are exactly 10 years apart. I'm 37, Ruby's 47, and Lisa's 57. So I still have a bit of a window, and Nick and I are, we're very like, if it happens, it happens, you know, like I'm not going to try. I'm not going to, I've had several friends go through IVF and IUI, and I'm like, I cannot relate to that desire. Like, wow, you really want to be a mom. And I just like, good for you, but I can't relate. So I think that raising my mother and kind of raising my father, yeah, to answer your question, I think it absolutely has me feeling apprehensive to bring more children into the world because I'm like, I've already done this. Now I can finally live my life in New York City as a renter, not a homeowner. And I feel free now. Like it really feels like my mom graduated college and I'm free.
You've got a kind of empty nest syndrome from your mom.
So, and it's no surprise that I adopted a puppy a couple months ago. So that all makes sense.
It does. It comes full circle. Yeah.
You know, it's funny, Ruby, when we were at your Strand event, me and a couple other sober friends, all women without kids, and we're all talking about our puppies, showing pictures of our dogs, talking about their poop schedules. And it was just so funny to me. I'm like, we're proudly not parents, but we are so obsessed with our dogs.
Yeah, that's not uncommon too. There's so much that I can relate to in everything you said, by the way. And actually particularly in the past few months, just doing all these launch events and speaking to so many people and getting lots of messages about the book, what you shared about, I haven't heard necessarily so many people put it in those very terms of like, I parented my parents, but certainly the feeling of having to take on responsibilities, caregiving responsibilities, whether physical, emotional, financial, at a very early stage in life, because of having parents who were incapacitated to give that to care in some way, is a common theme among people who have on some, often it's an unconscious level, questioned, do I want to take on another caregiving role, you know? Or do I want to actually want to dedicate the majority of my caregiving to myself, you know, and potentially to a partner and potentially to a pet?
Well, and that's where I am now. Like, I'm very happy in this like chosen family. You know, you talk a lot about that in the book. And, you know, I was also a caregiver for my maternal grandmother. My mom, back then I didn't have the words emotionally immature parents. But now I know, like, my mom couldn't emotionally take care of her aging mother, and her siblings were not around. Like, they were living elsewhere. So I, in my mid-20s, was my grandmother's primary caretaker. And this was when I was peak drinking. I mean, like, my alcohol abuse was very high during this point. So I really feel like I've done so much caretaking, and I'm exhausted, and it feels really good to live for me right now. Honestly, I feel like for the first time.
It's incredibly powerful. And just that small detail of, like, whilst in that caregiving role for your grandmother, perhaps drinking over the unfairness of that, drinking over the, this isn't my responsibility, and yet here I am saddled with it. I mean, that's the reality. It sounds kind of discompassionate to say that, or like, but it is the reality. It's not your responsibility, you know? And yet so many people, I mean, your mom was 21 when she had you.
Yes.
Baby. I mean, seriously, like, so young. And I think, there's so many people as well who can relate to having emotionally immature parents, and that actually being the norm, when it was normal for people to have kids in their early 20s, you know? And I think we're actually seeing, with such a kind of surge in interest around inner child work, reparenting, all these sorts of things, just a mass kind of awakening to the impact of being raised by people who didn't necessarily, through no fault of their own, have the emotional maturity to be a caregiver for small children. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's something else that you talked about in the book and at your launch event. You said it was something like, how do we value the entirety of a human life? And that, you know, it brings up so much. Like, I, like, super highlighted that in my book when I mentally, like, loaded it in my brain when you said it at the event. And, you know, we're talking about abortion. We're talking about people losing their children due to gun violence. We're talking about being childless due to circumstance. I mean, like, this isn't just a book about, yay, let's not have kids and live our best lives. Like, it really is it is the reality of being a woman who doesn't have children. And that includes people who have given birth that do not have children, you know? And, like, that just, I'm so glad you included that nuance.
Yeah. I wanted to speak to anybody who identifies as a woman without kids, regardless of the reasons for that. Those reasons could be physical, emotional, financial. They could be due to our relationship status. They could be due to infertility. It could be about choice. But then also really digging into, let's really look at the culture that we as women at the beginning of the 21st century have been raised in. Let's look at our inheritance in terms of our cultural and social and emotional inheritance. And let's sort of factor these external and internal influences on the current landscape, which is that the birth rate, like, globally, when I say birth rate, I mean the number of children being born to each individual woman, is dropping dramatically, drastically. I mean, it has been over the course of the past sort of 1.5 centuries, barring the blip of the baby boom following World War II, the birth rate has been dropping steadily. This is the reality. The reality is that more and more, there are more and more women without kids, and that I've actually heard from a lot of women who've chosen to have one child and been shamed for that decision, you know, as well, who've read the book and said, there's so much here that I can relate to too, because they get the same sort of pressure. When are you going to give them a sibling? Why aren't you going to give them a sibling? Yeah. Why are you being so selfish? Same start, same shit. So,
well, see, the only child in me is like, please have another kid for your kid's sake, because it fucking sucks.
But while single child families have doubled, there have doubled the number of single child families now compared to 1976. This is one of the fastest growing family demographic kind of shifts, because people are realizing, I don't necessarily have the capacity to do everything else I need to do in my life and have more than one child. Like, it's just not a possibility. I can't see how I'm going to make that work. So that's the reality for a lot of people. And with this reality, there are more and more women without children. Still, there is this incredibly entrenched cultural conditioning that says it is selfish, narcissistic, misguided. You're a failure. You're a freak. You've somehow missed out. You're going to regret it. So much negative, so many bad vibes around being a woman without kids. And it is the reality. It's going to continue to be the reality as society continues to be influenced by all of the factors that are playing into this. As we move forward through this century, it will probably even, I think we'll see an even steeper drop off in the birth rate among Gen Zs, particularly as more people opt out of becoming parents because of climate change. So this is an unstoppable demographic shift, which hasn't really been examined before. People haven't been within that lack of real deep examination, which again can lead to real deep compassion for people's circumstances. People are still feeling very shamed, very outsiderish. This path has just not been validated, you know? And that's really what I wanted to do with this book, is just say, for a civilization's worth of sort of conditioning and thought, it has been considered a woman's biological imperative to be a parent. And not just to be a parent of one child, but to be fruitful and multiply, right? And that is still the sort of like dominating view, and it's not the reality for the majority of women. And we need to start validating what is our reality, which is that for many of us, yay, we finally have the option to choose whether or not we want to become parents. And not only that, but to choose what we might want to do with our lives. For others, it might be like, fuck, it's too expensive to have a child. I cannot imagine how I'm going to be able to look after myself and meet all of my own needs and meet the needs of a child. And for others, it might be, shit, I was born into the wrong body. Like, I was born with the biological parts that don't equip me to make a child as a woman, right? For other people, it might be, I'm 35 and I'm struggling with fertility. And I was supposed to have a few more years here and I don't. And the most recent research shows that, you know, human fertility has been dramatically impacted by environmental factors and toxins in the environment, specifically microplastics in the food and water supply. Sperm counts have halved over the past four decades. The number of viable eggs that a woman has in her 30s is also massively reduced. So it's actually quite normal to experience fertility issues in your 30s. But again, the messaging that we receive is that that means there's something sort of wrong with you, you know? So all of this just hadn't really been properly examined, I don't think. So that's what I wanted to do with this book. So it's quite, it's kind of a meaty read. Tony, you said you've read it twice. I'm hearing that from a lot of people. I needed to read this twice to kind of, to get it all, you know? Like, it's really, really packed. Jam-packed with info and ideas and insights, and it was a heavy lift writing it, I have to say.
Well, the other piece of it, I think, that I found in reading it that was so powerful and probably, you know, makes it, you know, something to read twice and something that was incredibly difficult to write, is that it's the personal and the societal so entrenched. Like, we are clearly taught, listening to you and your personal story and journey. And it's a very vulnerable book at the same time that it is a lot of facts. Like, it is, you know, that to me seemed like, I remember reading it and being like, wow, this is, you know, how did she, you know, peg this to that in her own life, to this bigger thing, but you do. And so it really it's for anybody who, you know, wants to identify on a personal level, or is just curious on a personal level of, you know, even if they're a person with children or whatever, but like it's the combination of those two things that I think make it this is unlike anything I've ever read before.
I wanted to include really deeply personal storytelling because I wanted to, I don't know what's making me emotional. I wanted to meet people in the heart, you know? I wanted to write from the heart. Partly because those are the books I love to read. So much nonfiction is so fact-based, you know? And the nonfiction that I enjoy reading is often highly personal also. And so, yeah, and I guess this also came out of the sort of mindset I developed through the whole sober curious kind of portion of my career. I just have started to live my life with that curious mind of, I'm experiencing this. What are all of the factors at play in how I'm feeling about this, how I'm experiencing this, other people's expectations around this, how we as a society view this. And so it's sort of, that's kind of how I live my life now. Yeah. It's almost like this, I've been meditating daily for at least the past 10 years. I kind of live in this observer mind of I'm experiencing this and kind of what's actually really going on here. And so, yeah, that's what I wanted to do with this book, to meet people like, I'm here with you. Like, I've experienced all of this. And what's influencing our experiences of this? Mm.
That is, and I think that shines, your journalistic experience really shines in this book because of exactly that. Like, it's not just why Ruby doesn't have kids. It is, you know, Lisa knows I'm a total Carl Jung nerd. And so I see this as more of like, you know, there's like the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious, where it's like your stuff that you're working through, and then you zoom out, and then it's like, but why are you working through it? How are other people working through this? And, you know, and I took a similar approach with my book. It's like, yes, I talk about how liquid courage shows up for me, on how it showed up for me on dates and in the bedroom and early sobriety. But I wanted to know how it showed up for other people. And I interviewed so many people, because it's like, this is a huge conversation. It's a huge problem. And I really wanted to, you know, put on my journalism hat and figure out why is liquid courage on screen all the time? Why are we doing this? How is this impacting us? How is liquid courage, the ubiquity of liquid courage, how is that impacting us? And you did the exact same thing with this book. It's like, we are receiving so many messages from film and television and tradition and family. I am a woman, therefore I should procreate. And you just unpack it from a personal level with the heart, like you say. And we hear the heart from so many other people. Like, each chapter begins with these really vulnerable quotes from people that you interviewed.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something in all of this about, I don't know, just having a real sense that we are all connected, and that we're all a product of our environment. And on the most macro level, our environment is this planet. So, like, we're all in some way impacted by what's going down on planet Earth, right? And so by sharing our unique individualistic stories in relation to that, we offer people a mirror to look at, well, how am I then being impacted by what's going down on planet Earth, you know? And so looking at how we are all operating and required in many ways to operate within the systems that kind of are governing our societies and our culture, I think it's just a really valuable exercise, especially if we're in any way invested in reimagining new systems that might potentially work better for everybody who's involved, because everybody is involved, right? Everybody's involved in everything that's going down. So, like, the more we can validate people's individual needs, experiences, challenges within the systems that are operating, the more we can lean on or kind of agitate for change within those systems. I hope. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. It's a that's the kind of like the big picture plan, I suppose, with this kind of work, with being interested in putting these kind of books out there, of which, you know, your book is one of these books, Tawny.
Thank you for saying that. Before we go into the music minute, which I want to ask about Desperately Seeking Susan and Madonna, which you talk about a lot in the book, I have a question about the word like childless, child free, and then also it intersects with like alcohol free, you know? And is there a word, like, we have the word sober, you know? is there a word that doesn't reference, you know, alcohol-free references that I don't drink alcohol, child-free references that I don't have a child? Is there a more positive word?
Well, I'm quite annoyed that I landed on this after the book came out, but it came up in conversations that I've had since. So in the beginning, I opened the book with a chapter called The Motherhood Spectrum, which kind of acknowledges that we've had this very binary idea around, like, you're either a mother, therefore you are natural, you are validated, you are on the path to fulfillment, you have done your duty, or you're a non-mother and you are in some way defective. And I kind of present this idea of the motherhood spectrum, which is like, no, this is incredibly individualistic. There are many different factors that influence both our desire and our aptitude for parenthood, regardless of our gender, at various different times in our lives. And let's just like be more fluid about this. And I suppose within that spectrum too, there's also been a binary between like childless people who we feel sorry for because they wanted to have children and they can't for some reason. They're childless. But again, they are less a child. Or you've got the kind of child-free, which is designed to be a celebratory term, saying, no, this is a conscious choice. I'm freeing myself from the conditioning that says I have to be a parent. But I never really related personally to either of those terms. And they're both incredibly emotionally charged as well. Childless sounds so sad. Child-free sounds so kind of like empowered. And for me, I feel sad and empowered about not being a parent, right? In terms of my feelings. Same. In terms of my feelings about my, well, what I've been terming my a-reproductive status. So for me, somebody like me who has never had any desire to engage with the reproductive element of my sexuality, I'm starting to see that almost as its own sort of sexual orientation. So we have the term asexual to describe somebody who has no desire in sex. For me, using the term a-reproductive is just, it just makes it a fact. Mm. It's just who I am and it's just how I'm made. I just have no desire for that thing, right? So that's potentially one term that somebody might, like me, might use, right? And so, I don't know, there's a really interesting emerging concept called reproductive identity, which is actually calling for many different kinds of terminology to describe people's very different and individual and nuanced feelings and experiences in terms of engaging with their procreative potential. So for me, a-reproductive works. It sounds kind of a little scientific, but it just strips the emotion from it and it just states a fact. I have no desire to engage with the reproductive elements of my sexuality.
I like that a lot. It's good. Like, no, that's really good. Thank you for sharing that.
And so, yeah, within that, permission to anybody to think about, well, how would I describe my feelings about this then? Or not my feelings, my experience of being in this body in relation to this life, this area of life, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm in a group chat of people that do not want children. And someone was like, we're all like anti-child in this group, right? And I was like, I guess I'm baby neutral. Or they said we're all anti-baby, right? And I was like, I'm baby neutral. I don't, if it happens, cool. If it doesn't happen, cool. So maybe we could throw baby neutral in there.
Baby neutral is good. Baby agnostic. I've heard baby agnostic, which is kind
of. Oh, I like that.
I'm weighing my options here.
Okay. So quickly, if you could tell us about Desperately Seeking Susan and Madonna, because you talk about that a lot in the book and it makes me want to rewatch the movie.
Yeah. So I talk about this at the beginning of chapter 3, where I'm talking about how, I mean, really that chapter is about how Gen X women, that is women who were born from the late 1960s, kind of early 1970s onward, being the first generation to have been born against the backdrop of the women's liberation movement. We were the first generation who really from birth received the message, you can do and be whatever you want with your life. Like, your gender is not a barrier to you living your life on your own terms. The first generation. And I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing this kind of interest in this subject now, because guess what? It's roundabout now that Gen X women are starting to experience menopause. And we're going to actually see the true impact of that message on the birth rate, right? As more people have been more empowered to make other choices about what to do with our lives. And so I just, yeah, in that chapter, I kind of talk about all the sorts of references that I grew up with about what it meant to be a woman. And one of the most powerful kind of icons of my development of a self-concept of what womanhood could be for me was Madonna's character in Desperately Seeking Susan, the Susan character. She's just so, she's such a sexy rebel, you know? And yeah. She, there's this scene where she arrives in New York Port Authority bus station, and she takes this incredible bag that she's got. I'm sure many people are familiar with this scene. And she goes into the restroom and she kind of opens up this case, which has just got all her like stuff, all these like cool outfits. And she changes her outfit and she washes her armpits and dries them under the like hand dryer. And I'm just like, oh, she's so free. She's so free. You know, I think that was it. She just seems so, compared to all the other like female characters that I've been exposed to as a child, I think I was about 10 years old when I saw that movie for the first time. She just seems so free. I guess that's what I meant by rebellious, you know, like she was just like, mm-hmm. It wasn't even like, yes, that character in particular, kind of a zero fuck.
She was nonconformist.
She was nonconformist. And she was just kind of, she was uncontained and uncontainable. She was just living and being and enjoying her life, you know? So yeah, I think that she was just such a powerful character. And like I said, kind of icon in a way. And what I discovered that didn't come up in the, I didn't find a place to include this in the book, but the woman who directed Desperately Seeking Susan directed the pilot episode of Sex and the City. Because I also think it's very interesting that in the Sex and the City show, which was such a huge mainstream show, only one of the characters has a biological child. And that's an accident. Mm-hmm. She wasn't planning on it. It kind of fucked up her life. And then, of course, you have one of the characters who can't conceive. So I think that was actually, you know, in all the ways that that show can seem quite regressive now, I think it was very progressive in the ways that it displayed women's relationship to motherhood, you know? And so I just, I'm interested in I can't remember the director's name, but it was fascinating to realize that she had directed Desperately Seeking Susan and to see the similarities. And for her as well, for New York City, which is where I kind of, you know, I moved when I was 35. So I was in New York for that kind of, those panic years of, am I going to do this thing? Am I going to do this thing? You know? And I think being in New York surrounded by very progressive, rebellious women was actually a really good place to be when it came to sticking to my own truths around this subject, you know? Mm.
Yes, yes. Ruby, thank you so much. This was such a rich conversation. It was therapeutic for me.
And me as well.
Yeah, thank you for going there. And we're going to include links to Women Without Kids, Sober Curious, Material Girl, your first book. And if you're, you know, like if you're like me and you've already read her book twice, Ruby also has a companion podcast of a bunch of interviews that, you know, were kind of left on the cutting room floor, and she used them for, you know, she's keeping the conversation going. The podcast is also called Women Without Kids. So, Ruby, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Ruby.
Thank you for having me. It's awesome. So nice to talk to you as always. I hope I see you in person soon.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you so much. And have a good week, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. If so, please hit subscribe and consider rating and reviewing us so others can find us. Tawny, how can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Tawny M. Lara on all of the social medias. You can find my blog, sobrietyparty.com. Lisa, how can we find you and your amazing book?
My book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it is available at bookstores everywhere and online. And you can find me at lisasmithadvisory.com. And I'm on social media at Girl Walks Out. Thanks for listening.